This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on another interesting weather day across North Dakota, particularly where we are right now. At any rate, we're inside listening to the radio, we hope, or online, because we stream, of course, live, and it's a podcast after that. So we're going to start our show today with somebody who's from a very different climate, but who has accommodated himself to ours today because he's visiting us from Nashville, Tennessee, and originally he's from South Sudan. Dr. Gatluak Tach is the founder, president, and CEO of the Nashville International Center for Empowerment. Thanks for joining us today.
Nice to be here.
You are a refugee from South Sudan.
Correct.
So your organization helps refugees and immigrants settle in these new places as new Americans, right?
Right.
Give us your story.
Well, I thank you so much for having me. I am a product of refugees resettlement. I came from South Sudan and other countries. But before I left South Sudan, I went to different countries before then. I left South Sudan because of the war that happened between the Sudan, within the Sudan itself, before South Sudan independent. I left it, went to camp in the refugees in Ethiopia, stayed in Ethiopia for a while, then left the camp after I was conscripted to the military. Then I turned back to the camp afterward. And then stay there for a while and then leave the camp again to cross countries until I arrive in Kenya. I stay in Kenya for 2 years together with my young brother, then left Kenya to come to America through an agency that actually allowed me to come to South Dakota and stay in South Dakota for a few weeks before I left for Tennessee. And I'm now living in Tennessee.
How long have you been in Nashville?
I've lived in Nashville since 1996.
So let's talk about South Sudan, because it is still a very troubled place, and there are still lots of refugees from South Sudan. There are about 12.5 million people there now, I think. Mm-hmm. How many people do you think have left South Sudan?
A lot of people have left South Sudan. You know, South Sudanese refugees are number three in the population of refugees all over the world. Uh-huh. There are three countries that are actually having a lot of refugees. The first one is Syria, then Afghanistan, and South Sudan.
Wow.
So South Sudan's refugees are all over. Those who left South Sudan to Kenya, to Uganda, to Ethiopia, and to Sudan are pretty much close to 2 million people. There are a number of them who are also displaced within South Sudan. Those who are protected by the UNHCR, and those who are just leave their home and they're staying somewhere within South Sudan. So the crisis in South Sudan is a humanitarian crisis, and it's really a big crisis.
Well, as we were talking before we got in front of the microphones, I just recently returned from Uganda, mm-hmm. where I met and talked with a lot of South Sudanese refugees who are living there.
Right.
And I think about 1.5 million live in Uganda now in refugee camps, some of them absolutely huge, more than 250,000 in one of them.
Yeah.
And these are not – they're refugee camps, but mm-hmm. they're not comfortable places.
These are not comfortable places. Refugees, when they left their home and be settled in a place where they seek refuge, they are not given the opportunities that they need. They are living in places where they just make a living. There are no opportunity for them. So it is not a comfortable place. There's no comfortable places. And there will never be any comfortable places for refugees, being South Sudanese or other refugees for that matter.
Yeah, they're given just a bit of land and they can build a shelter on it or not. They have to fend for themselves largely. Who is left behind to build this new nation and a better nation, one would hope, in South Sudan?
Nobody. I would say that. But again, there are people in South Sudan who have remained in the country. But those people cannot do anything if the people of South Sudan who have left the country have not yet returned home. There is a peace that has been signed in Khartoum, South Sudan, last September. If that peace holds and refugees return, then hopefully they will rebuild their life and they will contribute back to the to the life of the country. But now the few leaders who are causing this crisis and living in the country, they can't do anything to bring peace alone, live alone, sustaining the life of the rest of the people in the country.
It's a very poor place.
You could say that it's poor because of the war. South Sudan is one of the richest countries in the world.
In terms of resources, yes.
But because of the war that has been there for a long, there's no cultivation, there's no access to all the resources that are there, and people cannot do anything to help themselves. So majority of people are depending on the UN aid, on handouts from other people, and that is really a tragedy that no one would want.
Let's talk about your organization, the Nashville International Center for Empowerment. How many people do you serve?
We serve a lot of people. Nashville International Center for Empowerment had a mission, and the mission is to give back to the community through social integration. So we are doing a lot. We are at a settlement agencies. We are empowering refugees and immigrants in our locality. We advocate for the rights of refugees and immigrants all over the world. Locally, what we do, we provide education program, we provide career development services, we provide, health services, health education, integration services, community empowerment services, immigration services. We do a lot. We do a lot. And why we are doing this is because there are need in the community. There are need that have been that and the people who have been neglected because of the lack of resources, and we're trying to respond to those needs. And doing that, it means that we have to work harder through partnership, collaboration, and fixing support that we will be able to meet the demand that are significantly needed.
The Fargo-Moorhead area has been accepting refugees for about 70 years now from all over the world. Eastern Europe, obviously, the Bosnian conflict. And there are a number of South Sudanese in Fargo. There are Somalis. There are people from other parts of Africa as well. Is there a significant South Sudanese population in Nashville?
Nashville has a significant number of South Sudanese and Sudanese. They have been there, some of whom were settled not in Nashville. They were settled in places like in Midwest. They also Midwest East and also in different places. And they migrated to Nashville for some reason. They became a secondary migrant. People like myself, I was settled in South Dakota.
Were you looking for each other? Is that why?
We do. We were supporting. We are a community that actually worked together, figured out a way to support one another. But also there were need in those the thing that we think are so important. And having to live together with someone that will be able to look up to you and support you in whatever ways possible locally as an ethnic institution, as an ethnic group, it's really what makes people be picking out a way to be together.
Last week we had Letitia Mazzaro Hellerud on our show. She's written a couple of books about being a refugee and about integration, and I use the word assimilation, and she immediately corrected me. It's not like we're getting rid of our culture or our background. We're becoming part of this community. We're bringing our identity here, too.
I totally agree with that. I also wrote that in my book, and integration is a champion that we all wanted to see. We wanted to live as a two-ways, accepting two-way integration, be part of the community in which you are a part of. I would want to see people in Fargo to live together with refugees and integrated refugees that are here with them, learn the civic and engage in the community activities and also reach out to them, but also learn the culture and the language, but at the same time keep your tradition, keep your ways of the things, keep some of the things that are good for your culture. There might be things that you might not really want to keep. And those things that you don't want to keep here, you will let them go. But things that are so important, you have to have them. The same thing in a new country. There are things that you don't want to learn, and things that you don't want to learn, you don't need them. So I think it has to be two-way.
You've written a couple of books. You've got a couple more coming out. My New American Dream is a book that you wrote, mm-hmm. and you were in Fargo to give an address, Strategic Responses to Human Rights and Cultural Diversity, and that's tomorrow evening at 6 o'clock at Dakota Medical Center. And it's a Fargo-Moorhead International potluck. It's sponsored by South Sudan Reads.
Right.
Tell us about that organization.
South Sudan Reads, as I learned, is a strategic institution here in Fargo and actually work together in collaboration with a number of the organizations here locally. And I'm very honored to be invited by them to come here. I see them that they are working in the way of integrating people to the community through education. So education, partnership, and immigration services. So those are things that are so important for New American. New American needs support, but again, it's just a matter of time for them. After a while, they really give back a lot to the community. And I think organizations like Reed is an institution that if it's receiving the support that it needs, it will be able to impact the life of people here in Fargo for years to come.
You're talking about strategic responses to human rights and cultural diversity. Can you give us a sense of the message you're going to share?
I would just talk a little bit on why it is important for us to be together and work together, and also look back to where we are today, look back to how we came to where we are today. And again, the crisis that are facing us today, the humanitarian crisis that are facing us, the human crisis that we, the human, can also address and figure out the best way to do that. Locally in Fargo, there are ways that you guys can address the issues that are happening in South Sudan. Even looking into how you are organizing and working and doing things together here, if you're doing in the collaboration and move beyond the concept of only me and not anyone else, then you should be able to do a lot. And I think my message would be how we can all work together, how we can build a unified forces that will confront the current challenge that we face, or that we have this time now in the first century as the human people.
Your organization, Nashville, the International Center for Empowerment, what specific things do you do to help these new Americans integrate into the Nashville culture?
Well, like I say earlier, we do a lot. So language barrier, we provide education. We also provide a cultural orientations. We also provide a culture connection, like community have to work together, address the barrier of language, barrier of culture, and barrier of way people can actually integrate it in sense that they can dialogue, they can accept the different religions, the different culture, a different way of life. How do you overcome this to be able to meet to a next level? We see things that people cannot do alone if they are part of the community. But at the same time, we have to have support. The people that are really needed to be better, they have to receive the kind of support that they need, a direction that they need in order for them to be able to overcome the ongoing challenges that are facing them.
How would you describe the welcome in Nashville for new Americans? Is it a difficult transition for people who live in Nashville, or are people open to the idea? What kinds of obstacles or opportunities do you see?
There are opportunities in Nashville for welcoming, but Nashville has changed so much from the time that I moved it to that city to today. It has grown to where it became more diverse. Nashville has the number one Kurdish community all over besides Kurdistan. There are a number of other ethnicities that are living in Nashville. It, you know, areas like, for example, the Nolenbe Road area where it's close to my office, it's international. You would see every store, every restaurant with a different type, and really, you really love it. But at the same time, there are also need for bigger broader dialogue on how we can actually live together and overcome our barrier. There are barriers of knowledge. That we lack knowing one another, and knowing, if we learn a lot about who we are as people, we will know if there are a lot of things that are really unifying us, that are really putting us together more than things that are dividing us.
You know, this part of the country was settled initially by English, then Germans, then Norwegians. As a matter of fact, I think Minnesota has more Norwegians than Norway now.
Right.
So these immigrations, these changes in the culture ultimately create a different place, and one would argue a better place.
Mm-hmm. Well, change is a change, and sometimes it is difficult for people to go through change. And there's no doubt that the people who may not be willing to see the change comes that soon. But change is important. Change is also better, and especially when people are diverse and they are working together, learning about one another, and trying to figure out how they can actually overcome their differences and addressing the same thing. Because what do the people want? People want to live in a better neighborhood. They want to live in a security neighborhood. They want to have a better economic empowerment. They wanted to learn the language. They wanted to have a good education. They want their children to succeed. They want to be part of the community. They want to contribute positively to the community. Everyone has the same thing, the same concept. And how do we go about it? That's what sometimes people define it differently. But if you look into it, all this change that we see are good. And if we can embrace them, we can actually be better people.
When I was in Uganda, I was impressed with the importance of education. It is not universally available by any means, but it is certainly prized. And it would seem that South Sudan, with a very young population now, and Uganda with a rather young population, that the lack of education, when it's really needed, will create a problem further down the way.
It is a challenge. It is a concern that the leader should listen, and the people should find a way to address it now. So far, during the five years of this crisis, there's already been a gap. There's already been a gap that will not be filled soon, a gap that a human capital gap that will not really be easy to cap. Now you look at the people who run out of the countries, who are also in the places where they are not easily getting education. You know, you could say those who are in Uganda or maybe in Ethiopia or Sudan, those who are lucky enough, they might access some sort of education. But I also know there are a number of people who don't access the education because, like you say, it's not easy. It's not easy. It costs to educate yourself. But if you don't have the support, you don't get it. And if you don't get it and the people don't get it, what does that really tell? I tell that there is going to be a gap, there's going to be a lack of it, and there's going to be a challenge ahead. And South Sudan has a long way to go now, and it will take years to recover that.
Well, you clearly prize education. Tell our listeners your education.
Well, I came here with no education. I was a child soldier. I came here with no English. I went and put myself in education, tried to learn English one at a time. I was successfully able to get my high school diploma. Then I went to a college. I went to Tennessee State University, where I teach now. I got my bachelor degree in computer science and a minor in mathematics. Then I went to one of the universities to get my master degree, and then went to get my doctorate degree. It was not really easy for me to do that. It was a commitment. It was a perseverance. It was a dedication, and also it took a lot of my time to do that. And it is just because I like to do it, and I also pray to do it, and I got the support that I need to be able to do it. It was difficult, and I know some of my friends that will try it, and who were successful, and some of my friends who tried who did not really get the chance to be successful. It wasn't because they didn't really want it, but it was because it does take a different sort of a commitment for you to be able to get acquire that much.
Well, it's a reminder that a person who's a refugee, who's really seen a very, very difficult life, can aspire to a much better one, and one way to get there is through education.
Education is a key for anything. I believe that if we are educated, we can do a lot together. We can actually be able to form the thought of a union that we need. We can be able to have the kind of country that we like. We could be able to address every issue that we needed to address. Education is the key for anything as people. And I think if there are a way for people to get education, especially like the organization that are working on education empowerment, that is the better thing. If there's anything one can actually do to support, it's support a program that does education.
Now, South Sudan, as we've mentioned a bit, has different ethnic groups. And during these times of strife, sometimes those ethnic groups clash. Does any of that come here with refugees?
You know, the war that is about to be end, if peace sustained, affects people here in the West. I know we did not have crisis in terms of community fighting among themselves, but it does disconnect the community. It does disconnect the community. It also carries a bigger burden when people were hearing a lot of things that are going on back home. And people were concerned what they can do to address those. You lose a relative. You hear every news every single day about people that got killed in exile and exile. That contribute to suffering that people have here. There are trauma here. People traumatized here, and it is becoming a challenge to the community. And those kind of things may not cause such a division within the community, but it has not connected the community. There's not a lot of things that have been done together for the last few years because that people also fear if they got together, the group, what would happen. You know, if people were talking, because South Sudanese are like another refugees organization, a refugees group, they like to talk politics. And if they talk politics, and the politics is what actually caused the deaths back home, then what would happen?
So it's not just integrating into the greater American society, it's integrating among yourselves as well.
Integration among ourselves is also important, especially if there is a peace, then people will easily integrate it. If there is if this peace sustained, then people will forgive themselves. They will go back to people. South Sudanese are very lovely people. They love themselves. They like to socialize. They like to eat food. They like to do a lot, dancing and et cetera and et cetera. And they like to have friendship with so many people. So if there's that peace sustained, then they will actually be able to overcome all this and all these challenges and address their way forward.
I went to a South Sudanese church service in Kampala. Mostly refugees in this church. It started at 1 and ended at 5. It's the longest church session I've ever been through.
You know, I understand that. I understand. We know the time that it ends. Sometimes we don't know the time it starts. and sometimes it ends before the other people, after the other people left. That has been that the culture of time is a Western culture a lot. It's not really, the time is not 5 to 6. It's 5, it's any time before it is 6, it is 5.
Dr. Gutluck Toch is the founder, president, and CEO of the Nashville International Center for Empowerment. He calls it NICE, and he's here to speak about strategic responses to human rights and cultural diversity Thursday evening at 6 at the Dakota Medical Center in South Fargo. There will be a Fargo-Moorhead International Potluck, and this is sponsored by South Sudan Reads. Thank you for spending some time with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up on Main Street, the banker and the Blackfoot. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The Public Service Commission has okayed the siting for a new 298-megawatt wind farm near Linton. Emmons Logan Wind, a subsidiary of NextEra Energy Resources, will build the farm on 28,000 acres. It will have 123 wind turbines. The company has a contract to sell the power to Great River Energy. PSC Chairman Brian Crosha says he was very impressed at the community support for this project.
From first responders to school officials to community leaders to citizens, there was very, very strong and robust support for the project. And they cited the fact that that region, that area, is predominantly agriculture. And when commodity prices are low, These easement payments not only help farmers that have turbines on their land, but it helps the local community. It helps expand the tax base. So they looked at it as an opportunity in an area where they don't have many coming along.
The company wants to have the wind farm in service by December. It will have a new aircraft detection lighting system, which only turns tower lights on when an aircraft is in the area, cutting down on blinking red lights. The commission also approved a nearly 7-mile-long high-voltage power line to bring the wind power to an existing transmission line. Minnesota U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar will likely join the growing list of candidates running for president. The Democrat says a big announcement will be made on Sunday in Minneapolis. MSU Moorhead political science professor Barbara Hedrick says Klobuchar will have to set herself apart from the other candidates.
Especially, I think you might hear some emphasis on her Midwestern appeal, since the Democrats lost a few Midwestern states they didn't expect to last time, and even Minnesota was closer than they wanted. And also look for how much the reaction very quickly becomes, well, wouldn't she be a good vice presidential candidate? She was even talked about in 2016 as a vice presidential candidate, and I think that will stick around as well.
Hedrick says Klobuchar tends to receive very good press attention, but she says she's not sure how well-known Klobuchar is across the country. Former Vice President Walter Mondale was the last Minnesota Democrat to win the nomination in 1984. And the executive director of the North Dakota Soybean Growers Association says they are still sorting through details of last week's announcement that China will be buying more U.S. soybeans.
People thought it might be 5 million metric tons a day, and that would be a staggering number of soybeans. And so it seems that it is 5 million metric tons over the course of some period of time, which has not been defined. And we are unable to learn if these are soybeans that really were already in the intent to buy or if they simply were new soybeans.
Nancy Johnson says China uses a huge amount of soybeans. She says since the trade war started with the U.S., China has shifted its purchasing to countries like Brazil. Johnson says they are hoping a report due this week will answer the question of whether the Brazil supplies can meet the demand.
The report that would have told us more about that kind of got stopped during the furlough of federal employees, and we hope to see that on Friday. That'll give us a little better idea, but since so many of our soybeans do go through the Pacific Northwest to China, and they just weren't buying U.S. soybeans, we're thinking we have a lot of soybeans that we would love to sell to them.
Johnson says the U.S. is 88.7% behind when comparing soybean shipping rates of 1 year ago. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by phone with J. Edward Chamberlain. He is the author of the book, The Banker and the Blackfoot, An Untold Story of Friendship, Trust, and Broken Promises in the Old West. He joins us from British Columbia, Canada. Thank you for being with us, Jed.
It's a pleasure.
Why did you write this book?
Well, two reasons. One is because I have been thinking about telling the story of my grandfather's, which I grew up with, and of his relations with the Blackfoot and time and the place, the 1880s, 1890s in southern Alberta, northern Montana. But there was something else. I was thinking in some ways about the present rather than the past, and about how kind of division and distrust and disrespect have become so common, and belief in the future somewhat scarce around the world. And I thought of this as a time and a place on the Northern Plains that offers a story with hope for the future of our communities, because it does give an example of First Peoples, the Blackfoot, and the New Peoples, the settlers, living together in ways that defied the forces designed to pull them apart. I mean, it wasn't a perfect time for sure, but it was a time when people there, the ranchers, some of the settlers, there weren't many farmers in that area because it's dry country, and the Blackfoot were all looking for solutions rather than problems, and in some ways for friendships rather than feuds, and not about who to blame, but about how to get through what was a very, very tough time for the Blackfoot, with the buffalo gone and the railway come, and the settlers moving in slowly, and the future uncertain. And the ranchers, for them, never an easy time with the weather and all of the things that can happen on the open plains. So it was it's a remarkable community that developed there and that lasted for about 20 years until all kinds of things started to happen. Settlers, there was a kind of gold rush of settlers out to that part of the world, and and Canada continue to break all its promises made under treaty.
J. Edward Chamberlain is the author of The Banker and the Blackfoot. I should also mention you're Professor Emeritus of English and Comparative Literature at the University of Toronto. You're a Fellow of the Royal Society of Canada, an Officer of the Order of Canada. So you have a personal interest in this story and an academic background in covering this kind of thing. Who was your grandfather?
My grandfather was John Cowdery. He went by the name of Jack, who, on my mother's side, who had been grown up until he was in his late teens in Ontario, and then went out with his brother, Nathaniel, to Saskatchewan, to a place called Pile of Bones.
Wow. Lots of buffalo bones, I take it?
Lots of buffalo bones, which were piled up in an old Cree belief that the buffalo would come back to where the bones were. This was, it was named well before the demise of the buffalo, and they were there in the, around 1880, 1881. Pile of Bones is now the town of Regina. They decided to change its name.
Sounds a little better.
Sounds a little better, yeah. The folks were fairly grumpy about it, the settlers. There weren't many settlers, just a dozen or so in the area. They lived there for a couple of years, my grandpa and my brother and his brother, built a sod house, and then they kind of got looking further west, and they had heard good stories about the Blackfoot. They had heard good stories about the weather. We all look for good weather, and the Chinooks in the foothills, the Front Range there, bring warm weather very suddenly often, several times a winter, often more often even than that, and they liked the idea of moving on. So they went out to Fort McLeod and settled in there. They also knew of the success of the Northwest Mounted Police that had been established about 6 or 8 years earlier and moved and made their headquarters in Fort McLeod. And so they sort of liked the idea that the relations between the police and the Blackfoot was on good terms, so they were more confident than others about an Indian war breaking out in that part of the West.
Well, your grandfather, Jack Cowdery, was the banker in the title of the book and the first mayor of McLeod.
He was the first mayor of McLeod, yes. He started a little bank. Year after he arrived there, he knew a bit about banking because he'd worked as a teenager in a bank in Ontario. Didn't have a lot of money, but he must have had good instincts because he did well, and he understood a fair bit about farming and ranching and about horses. And somehow, he and the community made it through. The first year he opened the bank in 1886, and that winter was a terrible winter throughout the Northern Plains.
Mm-hmm.
It became known as the big die-up rather than the big roundup in the spring. Many of the ranches lost more than half their herds, and everyone took a whitewashing. I mean, many were nearly wiped out, but he just extended the loans, canceled the interest, and said, let's get through the next year.
Wow.
And they all did.
Well, there are photos in the book, and McLeod looks like a lot of Western places we've seen in the movies. What kind of place was it to your grandfather?
It was a ramshackle little town with some shacks and buildings. The difference was that the Northwest Mounted Police fort was also nearby, and that was pretty solidly built. But for the rest, it was a town with certainly more bars than dress shops, and lots of lively characters and things going on. It had some differences from the small western towns in the Northwest, in Montana and Idaho and Wyoming and such, in that the police had come in 1874 they'd been established by the government really to go out and establish law and order in the West. And they rode across the country and settled in Fort McLeod. Their first order of business was to shut down the whiskey trade. which was devastating the Indian communities. As devastating lots of people, but in particular the Indian communities were really getting to be fairly brutal places with all kinds of violence, not so much between them, but within the communities. And they were remarkably successful in doing that. There was a fort called Fort Whoop-Up, up a trail called the Whoop-Up Trail from Fort Benton.
Because of the whiskey?
One of the main centers of... It was well named. It was one of the main centers of trading. Now, the trading was in lots of other things, too. They'd bring dry goods and various other things up, blankets, to trade, rifles, but lots of whiskey. And their first stop when they got west into Alberta, what's now Alberta, was at Fort Whoop-Up, where they found it was well with it's near Lethbridge, so it's well on the Alberta side of the border. But what they found was the old fort there, an old fort in pretty good shape, with a makeshift American flag flying.
Oops, wrong place.
Wrong place. They thought this got to change. It turned out it wasn't a terrible place. There was only one trader there at the time who invited them in for dinner, and they stayed there. They stayed camped nearby and stayed there. They'd been all set for a real fight with whiskey traders. They then started to clean up the territory of whiskey traders, and the first person they arrested was a man named Camoose Taylor, and he was a big-time trader, bringing lots of whiskey and, as I say, in blankets and rifles and kitchen gear and various other things to trade with folks. But they arrested him and confiscated, I think he had 8 or 10 wagons and all of his horses and, of course, all of his whiskey and all of the other supplies and sent him on his way. They didn't have any place to put him in jail at the time, but just, and they fined him. They gave him a fine, too. And he turned around and went straight and established a hotel, the McLeod Hotel, which became famous in the territory and served, this time, legal liquor to the same folks who'd taken all of his illegal liquor from him. But the key point here is the Mounted Police were respected by the Blackfoot because they'd pretty near wiped out the whiskey trade. Mm. Even the chiefs, who some of them were certainly drinkers too, they were enormously grateful. The head of the Mounted Police, James McLeod, was a man with a kind of old-fashioned belief that his word was his bond, and he kept his word. Canada didn't keep its word, but he kept his word, and so he was very much trusted by the Blackfoot.
Your grandfather was Jack Cowdrey, and
yes,
the other person in the title, the Blackfoot, is a fellow by the name of Crop-Eared Wolf, a Blackfoot leader.
He was the son of Red Crow, who was the chief right through treaty time, right from the late 1870s, right through to 1900, and then Crop-Eared Wolf took over. He was his son and took over as chief of the Blood tribe among the Blackfoot. The Blackfoot is a confederacy of three Blackfoot tribes and one Sarcee tribe. But Red Crow was a formidable figure in his time, and so was Crop-Eared Wolf.
And how did he and your grandfather become friends?
They met by chance. They, the story goes, and these are stories that all came down through my family, and some of them from Blackfoot folks I've talked to over the years. Grandpa was riding out of town just after he arrived, and saw a fellow riding into town with a bunch of horses. It was Crop-Eared Wolf. They stopped and had what must have been a kind of fairly simple conversation because my grandpa didn't speak Blackfoot at that time, and Crop-Eared Wolf spoke some English, but not a lot. But they, in one of those sort of marvelous ways of friendships, they liked each other, and they promised to meet again, and they did indeed. They saw each other a few times over the next while. And then that bad winter of 86, 87, in February, my grandpa was riding down to Cardston, right by the border, which was then called Lee's Creek. And a Chinook came, and he got snowblinded. when the weather turned bright and sunny with the snow, with the light shining off the snow and the ice. It was a hazard. Everyone knew about the hazard, but even the best of the plainsmen sometimes got snow blinded. Anyway, his horse just took the lead and took him into Crop-Eared Wolf's camp in Standoff, it was called, right down by the new reserve there. And so Crop-Eared Wolf recognized him, took him in, brought him back to good health over the course of a week. And that was the beginning of a real friendship, a deep friendship over the next 20 years.
J. Edward Chamberlain, Ted Chamberlain, is the author of The Banker and the Blackfoot, An Untold Story of Friendship, Trust, and Broken Promises in the Old West. And there are some very interesting characters in your book, Ted, because you refer to the Sundance Kid, and Frank Dickens, the son of Charles Dickens, shows up.
Yes, he came over from England as Francis Dickens, and that name was quickly shortened to Frank. He joined the Northwest Mounted Police. He was, everyone agrees, absolutely useless as a police officer, but he was a very good drinker.
Yeah.
So he told stories, not as well as his dad did, but he told good stories in the bar in the McLeod Hotel, and folks got to know him. And then he went, he was posted, because the Northwest Mounted Police kept trying to find a place to put him where he wouldn't do too much damage. And he was posted back to Saskatchewan. Unfortunately, just at the time that Louis Riel rose up and took on the Canadian, took on Canada with a rebellion.
This is Louis Riel the Métis, right?
Louis Riel the Métis, yeah.
Your godmother was Métis.
My godmother was Métis, yes. Yeah. And my grandfather, Jack, knew Louis Riel from friends in Capel. For Capel, when he was at Pile of Bones. So he went, my grandfather went back to Regina for Riel's trial to support him. To us, seems very surprising, but in fact, it wasn't as surprising at the time as we might think, because many of the people in the West were angry about the way the East, Ottawa specifically, the capital, federal government was treating the West.
Well, this is Canada and the U.S. had sort of similar ways of bending treaties.
We did. No, absolutely. And we all, I grew up in the West. I grew up with nothing short of contempt for the East.
Okay. Even though you taught at Toronto.
That's right. No, you go where the job is. I love the city of Toronto. But I was filled with stories about how we were exploited by Ottawa. You know the story.
Well, this is a fascinating time in history because this is the time when North and South Dakota become states, Montana becomes a state, Idaho becomes a state, Washington becomes a state. And so this boundary between the U.S. and Canada becomes a little more specific.
It becomes more obvious. Certainly for a stretch there, when my grandpa first arrived, it was very porous. And many of the people who became notable characters in his world had come up on cattle drives from Montana and Wyoming in particular. And so there was lots of connection. And, of course, the Blackfoot, many of their kin were Blackfeet, as they call themselves, south of the border. So they were back and forth all the time. And the Buffalo and Judith Basin and various of those areas were great hunting grounds during the time of the buffalo. But then mid-1870s, the buffalo started to just not be as many of them, to disappear. And there's a really chilling reminder of that in what is called a winter count kept on buffalo skins by Blackfoot elders. 1876, it notes plenty of buffalo. 1879, the entry written in Blackfoot is when first there were no more buffalo. Now, it was happening before 1876. People were recognizing that the buffalo were on their way out, but it happened. It's an environmental disaster on a scale that really it's hard to match in human history.
As you mentioned, the railroad was coming through. Diseases were decimating tribes that had not been introduced to these diseases before. The buffalo is going away. So let's jump ahead. a few generations. How would you describe the current relations between Canadian provincial governments and Indigenous peoples, First Nations in Canada these days?
Canada is still trying and not doing a very good job of remedying, recovering from so many broken promises. And it's interesting the difference between Canada and the States on this. No question, we came to the United States, broke lots of promises. But in 1871, which was the year Canada started signing treaties, the United States stopped signing treaties because it couldn't fulfill its obligations. It also didn't much like the treaties anyway, but and Canada signed them and then broke them, right, left, and center. It did not adhere to the terms of the treaties, to the territorial terms, saw them as land transfers, and they weren't. They were peace treaties. It didn't adhere to the promises they made to provide rations during tough times, because they could see by the end of the 70s that the buffalo were going, and there wasn't a lot else to hunt other than someone else's cattle. So we're still trying to recover from that. We're still trying to reestablish, really, the terms on which those treaties were signed, which were relationships between sovereign peoples in times of stress and difficulty, where it was clear that changes had to come through and be made by each side. But the Blackfoot back then were used to changes. They'd taken up horses just about 100, 150 years earlier. They knew all, and the horses transformed their lives. That was a good change. This is a bad change. The thing about the Blackfoot was interesting. They didn't look to blame anybody. They thought, what are we going to do next? They, of course, then turned to blaming the government for not keeping its promises. But even as the government didn't keep its promises, the Northwest Mounted Police tried their best to kind of fill in where the government wasn't keeping its promises. So they had some support. Right now, the other thing that Canada is recovering from, thank goodness, but it's not easy and certainly terribly hard for the Indian peoples in the country, is from the residential schools, as we call them, that took Indians from the reserves and tried to turn them into white folks.
That was a similar issue in our country, of course, too.
No, I know. And it was institutionalized by the national government in Canada in a way that was so overwhelming and relentless that in some ways it operated on a different scale. But either place, it was a terrible thing.
J. Edward Chamberlain is the author of the book The Banker and the Blackfoot, An Untold Story of Friendship, Trust, and Broken Promises in the Old West. It has some fascinating history and perhaps a historical lesson or two. Ted is also the author of If This Is Your Land, Where Are Your Stories? Finding Common Ground. He joined us by phone from, I guess, Half Moon Bay, British Columbia. Thanks for being with us, Ted.
Thank you very much, Doug.
Dakota Date Book is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Radisson Hotel in downtown Fargo, featuring a Valentine's package February 14th through the 16th that includes a guest room, four-course dinner for two, and wine or a sparkling cider delivered to your room. 701-232-7363 or radissonfargo.com.
Hey, this is Bill Thomas of Prairie Public, and thanks and congratulations, too, to everybody who joined up or renewed the short and sweet membership drive. Delicious cocoa truffles going out all over the place, and it's wonderful. If you haven't joined already, well, you can. You can call 800-359-4145 or go to prairiepublic.org up till February 8th. That's the deadline. So if you still want to get in on it, you can. Let's hear from you. And thanks to everybody who helped.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 6th. Jocelyn Burdick was the first woman to serve in the U.S. Senate from North Dakota, although it was never her plan. Born in Fargo on this date in 1922, her parents named her after her great-grandmother, Matilda Jocelyn Gage, who was a suffragette in the 1870s. Jocelyn grew up in Fargo and attended high school at Fargo Central. She went on to attend Principia College in Elsa, Illinois, and graduated from Northwestern in 1943. From there, she went on to become a radio announcer in Moorhead, Minnesota. During her time there, she met Kenneth Peterson of Grand Forks. They were married in 1948. They had two children named Birch and Leslie, but Kenneth died in 1958. 2 years later, she met and married Quentin Northrop Burdick, an ex-Fargo lawyer with four kids who is now serving in the United States Senate. Quentin served in the Senate for four more terms, where he gained a reputation for voting liberal and funneling federal funding into North Dakota. Jocelyn worked as his advisor and volunteered for his re-election campaigns. In 1992, Quentin Burdick died of heart failure. At the time, he was the third longest-serving senator. It fell to Governor George Sinner to name Burdick's replacement. He chose Jocelyn to complete her husband's work in Washington. Only after consulting relatives did she accept the appointment, and she was sworn in on September 12th. While in office, she joined the Public Works Commission, which her husband chaired until his death. She only spoke once on the Senate floor in her three-month term to say, "I'm honored to be the first woman to represent North Dakota in Congress. I hope that the 103rd Congress will find many more women seated in this body." Burdick served until December 14, 1992, when she stepped down and supported Kent Conrad's run for the seat. She then returned to Fargo, where she resides to this day. Only one woman, Heidi Heitkamp, has served in the United States Senate from North Dakota since Burdick's statement 27 years ago. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Newly elected Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is working to turn her sudden fame into power.
What I hope we're able to do is rediscover the power of public imagination.
She says President Trump had a vision for a border wall.
Despite the fact that it's not what the American people want, it's the only vision he has.
On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
A little time to remind you that we had our short and sweet membership drive last week, but there's still some time. If you haven't become a member yet or would like to increase your membership status, you can give us a call at 800-359-4145 or go online to prairiepublic.org or text the word support on your smartphone to 484848 and follow the link that we send. If you become a member at $10 a month as a sustaining member, we'll send a box of Nicole's Fine Truffles to any place in the continental United States before Valentine's Day. Thursday on Main Street, David Troyer is Ojibwe from the Leech Lake Reservation. He teaches creative writing at the University of Southern California, and we'll talk about his latest book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America from 1890 to the Present. Sue Balcom will join us to talk about some Main Street Eats features for Valentine's Day, and we'll look at our What's Happening calendar of events. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.